Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast. Hey, thanks for hitting up another episode of Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin, and this time out, it's stage number two of my conversation with Rick Zemla. He climbed that big Beech Ridge Mountain to the point where he was winning 12 races a year, some track championships, but where do you go from there? The logical answer? NASCAR touring. So Rick and Bill Griffin go touring in 1985, have some great results and some not-so-great results. We get into that. Rick eventually comes back to Beech Ridge in a fast car and, well, wins some more races, but wraps up his career shortly thereafter. But the final laps he turned in, whether it was his late model or a modified ride, they weren't the final laps he would turn at Beech Ridge. He resurfaces later in a full circle moment as a safety worker, a pretty crucial safety worker. We get into that story. Rick talks his golf game and a ton of other cool things, too. It was a fun conversation. And it's not possible without your support at Patreon. Patreon.com/OpenTrailerPodcast, whether it's a one-time donation or a recurring contribution to the show where you get early access to our episodes that will drop on Tuesday. So it will be an Open Trailer Tuesday instead of the traditional Open Trailer Thursday. But Patreon.com/OpenTrailerPodcast to contribute to the show. Sponsorship also available. Hey, this is a racing podcast, and racing doesn't survive without sponsorship. Just send me a direct message if you're interested in putting your business's name or just, you know, your name on the podcast. We accept any and all contributions. So let's get to it. It's a nice one. It's Rick Zemla, stage number two of Open Trailer Podcast. So you go on to win some big races too. You know, like the Big A Auto Parts race. The Thompson Machine 100. Your name always seemed to be at the top with these long distance races. Was there a secret sauce to that?
Well, the guy that owned the 01 car that we were talking about, him and Billy Griffin, Billy Griffin built the car, and Steve Roman and Billy Griffin did all the work on the car, and they just seemed to know what they were doing.
How easy did they make your job?
Very easy. That car, those 2 years that you were talking about when we got all those wins, that car would almost drive itself.
And, you know, this is right around the time the Pepsi Challenger comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
How did that deal come about? That was a really big deal.
Well, yeah. Darryl Waltrip had the yellow Pepsi car on the Grand National Tour. And Pepsi Cola locally called me up and asked if I was interested in taking on a sponsor and if we could talk about it. And I went over to Pepsi Cola.
So they approached you?
Yeah, they called me up and said that they wanted to do a Pepsi Challenger car.
Yeah.
And they got all the paint numbers and schemes and everything from Waltrip.
Really?
I don't say they got them from Darryl Waltrip himself, but from
the people that were handling that sponsorship.
Yeah, the car. And we got all the numbers for it, and they said they'd like to have us paint the car just like Walsenum's was. I said
Waltrip. Yeah.
Waltrip's was, and we did.
Did you ever come in contact with Darryl or Junior Johnson or any of those guys?
No, not really. Mm. I mean, I've said hi to Darryl Waltrip before. He came up to Oxford a couple of times when we was racing up there, but I wasn't tight with him in any way, shape, or form.
Who's the most famous race car driver that you've spent time with?
Harry Gant.
Nice.
Terry Labonte.
Who's the most famous guy you beat?
I won the feature race at Beech Ridge when Kyle Petty come up, and I beat Kyle Petty.
Now, let's talk about that, because, I mean, I'm reading the read-up on this race. You have Kyle Petty, who I think present-day fans know as the commentator, obviously Richard's son, but people forget how much of a badass driver he was in his own right in the 80s and 90s. And he was really coming into his own at that point. And he made a special attempt at Beech Ridge. And he wasn't just showing up and, you know, collecting the check. He was racing hard. Can you tell me about that night?
Yeah, he was a very nice guy. I mean, he was a kid, kind of. But he was, you couldn't ask for a better guy. I mean, he was very good to me. I know that. We talked and everything. And he made comments when they were doing the winning thing with me about, he says, I have to race a Pepsi Challenger on my other series. Now I got to race one up here.
And he still could. He couldn't beat any of them.
Kyle Petty was, I thought he was a great guy.
But tell me about that race. Because you guys were racing right down to the wire.
Yeah.
I mean, he showed up. And as far as I know, he was winning the race. You had to start out back. So tell me about coming up through the pack.
That was never easy. I don't want to say that I was good or anything like that. But
you can.
But it was never easy to start from the back.
Right. Because how many cars are starting the feature?
Back then, there was quite a few. I mean, I don't know the exact number, but I'd say that most nights in a feature race, we had anywhere from 24 to 28 cars.
Yeah, that's what I remember in the late model days.
Yeah.
So you had to start out back, and we're talking about this Kyle Petty race specifically, and you see there's one more guy to take down. And how are you passing these cars, by the way?
Just getting a move when you could make it. I mean, if you could go on the outside, you'd try the outside. And if you could go on the inside, you go on the inside.
The write-up says primarily you were running up the outside towards the last part of the race. So it's a late race charge coming to the checkered flag. And are you aware that it's Kyle Petty or is it just another race car?
No, I knew it was Kyle Petty that was behind me. Mm. I did know that because it wasn't a local car. Well, he ended up driving Calvin Reynolds' car, the Zero. Yeah, he had one from another racetrack, but the engine let go.
Oh, that's right. He had the backup car.
Yeah, so Calvin Reynolds got out of his car and offered his car for him to finish the race.
Mm.
And Calvin's car was that green and white one, and not hard to miss that when you can look in your rearview mirror every now and then and you can see it.
Hmm. So that's a pretty big win when you beat Kyle Petty. Tell me about the night that you were running the 1983 Thompson Machine 100. Well, you have the... by the way, Rick's mom. What's your mom's name?
Her name was Emily.
Emily. Emily Zemla?
Yep.
Emily Zemla did a wonderful job. Mom of the year right here, gathering all of your accolades.
Mm-hmm.
Where would your memory be of them without her?
Lost.
Yeah. Yeah. Moms always know. And I assume your mom was in the grandstands watching you every single week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tell me about your mom. What kind of person was she?
I think a very great person. I mean, she did a lot for all of us kids growing up.
How many brothers and sisters you have?
I had a brother and a sister, and she never gave us a hard time. We always did whatever she wanted and what she could do. She'd always treat us well.
Did she? Did you sit in the stands with her when you were a kid, going back to your first Beech Ridge days? So it must have been something to. To win those races, and because you can't see the people in the grandstand on race night, but you know your mom's there.
Yeah.
And it's your biggest cheerleader.
And she sat in the same seat every night.
Mm. Where was that?
Right down below the, probably about 6-7 rows up from the walkway and just to the right side of the announcing booth.
That's cool. That's cool. A final restart with only a few laps to go had everyone holding their breath, wondering who would be posting the honored victory of the Thompson Machine 100. But when the checkered flag finally fell at the finish line, God, they love alliteration, it was clear to see that Rick Zemla had become the third driver to win this race and collect the $2,000 winner's check, making the Thompson Machine 100 one of the richest 100-lap wins in New England. So you won that race, and you beat Ray Leach that night.
Yeah. And
Bob Reynolds. Yeah. But yeah, so Dick McCabe comes in and talk about the night that you, Beaver Dragon, and Dick McCabe are running for the win. I think this might be 1983. Might be the Ottawa's race.
Yeah.
Or Big A. Yeah. One of those big 100 lap races.
Right. Yeah. And me and McCabe were pretty much neck and neck all night long. And Beaver was, and I was in third, and I got by Beaver. And then when it came across to the finish line, all three of us just about came across all together.
Three wide.
Yeah. Wow. Well, not three wide, but McCabe was here. I probably, my front end was probably here to his back, and Dragon was on the inside of me.
What kind of guy was Dick McCabe to race against?
I got along pretty good with him. I don't have any bad things to say about him.
No. Who's the hardest competitor? We're not talking trash here, but the person that you would see that person, you know, as you're driving through the field and you're like, oh man, I got to deal with this bozo now. Who was the person that you were worried about racing the hardest?
Because there was different years. Homer Drew was one of them because when I was young, Homer Drew was winning everything. And then as Homer got older, I started winning a lot more. And Dick Walsenholm was tough to beat when I was really young. But like I say, when he got older, I started to get some wins. Ralph Cusack. And the one that still sticks with me to this day, Mike Rowe.
Yeah. Yeah, you and... I mean, you're right in that class, too. I mean, Mike's obviously a Hall of Famer, still competing to this day. You ever watch races today and be like, you know what, I could still get it done?
Driving the pace car, I used to see it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's skip ahead. Why not? We don't have to go chronologically. Your Beech Ridge history, your Beech Ridge experience comes full circle because you become a safety person. Not like your dad, but you pick up the job to be pace car driver right up until the end.
Yeah.
Of Beech Ridge. How did that whole thing come together?
Ralph and Andy.
Hmm.
Yeah. Andy gave me a call. They needed one, and Ralph brought it up to Andy, I guess. And Andy called me up and asked me if I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of stuff with my grandson at that time on Saturdays, and I said, I don't know if I can do it or not, but I'd like to bring my grandson with me. He said, not a problem.
That's cool.
Yeah. He said, not a problem.
How old is your grandson today?
19. He was 14 when he was first in the race car.
Yeah,
pace car. That's why I was worried about him not being able to do it.
Right. Yeah, now if you start when you're 14, you're old. But back in the day,
yeah,
you know, you had to be 18 to drive the race car.
Right.
So, I mean, pace car driving, just tell me about that experience, what that was like for you.
Well, most of those cars were front wheel drive.
Hmm.
And at first, they wanted me doing their pace laps with them. You know, and I'm looking at the speedometer, and it's getting up there, and, you know, we got a regular street car.
Yeah. How fast are you going around the racetrack? It doesn't look fast, but when you're out there,
yeah, there was a lot of nights that when they wanted me ahead of them, and when they were out doing their warm ups and stuff, 60 miles an hour.
Jeez, That's, I mean, I rode with you a few times, and you know, the G's were really kicking in, that's for sure,
yeah.
You know, on that car. Did you ever almost lose it?
No, I was fortunate enough that didn't happen. Yeah. I almost got hit, though.
Who almost hit you?
Ralph.
Really?
Yeah. He didn't.
Wait a minute. Was this the night that he drove over the racetrack during the ACT race?
Yeah.
What the hell?
He just missed me.
Yeah. For those that don't know, Ralph Cusack, he, in the middle of an ACT race, I don't know, maybe it happened more than once, but like the race is going on. We're not under caution. And you see that truck of his just come right over the lip, and you're like, I think he should really turn right at this point, or maybe left, like either go to the pits or go next to the turn. Nope, just go right over the racetrack, right into the infield. Yeah. It was like Mr. Magoo.
Yeah.
He's such a good guy. Do you remember, what's your coolest Ralph Cusack story?
Oh, I'd have a lot of them. I used to go up to his camp, when he was, back when he was a lot younger, and he had a place on Sebago and stuff like that. And when my father was working with him on the race cars and stuff, after the races were over, we'd go up to his house and they'd have a few beers, and we'd have us, the younger guys, would have sodas and stuff like that. And it would be a night hanging out.
Yeah. Did you grow up with Andy, or, you know, cross paths with him a lot?
Not until he actually came to Beechridge.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we kind of left off racing-wise, where you are the king of the mountain. I mean, there's, you know, nobody who's winning more races than you. 12 races in 82 and 83 each year. Championships, right? So you're at the top of late model sportsmen. There's another rung to climb, right? And then how does the deal come together where you're on the NASCAR North Tour?
Bill Griffin, the guy that built the cars that you were talking about that I raced at Beechridge, he asked me if I wanted to drive his car on the NASCAR Tour.
Wow. And had you raced anywhere besides Beechridge, and I'll even throw in Oxford. I assume you've been to Oxford a few times.
Many times at Oxford, yeah. I raced at Oxford and Beechridge up until that point. Pretty much that was it.
Right.
Yeah.
So the idea of going out and trying all these new tracks, what was that? How did that feel?
It was very different. I mean, anyone that went up there, Bobby Randall or any of the other guys that went up there, they'd have to tell you the same thing, because every track was different.
Hmm.
I mean, yeah, we had big tracks, we had small tracks, we had bank tracks, we had, and you know,
and Beech Ridge wasn't one of them.
No.
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 So you didn't even have a little home field advantage a couple times out of the year.
No.
The first ACT race at Beechridge was still a few years away. But tell me about opening day. I assume that would be Catamount for the Spring Green.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first time in that 77?
Yeah. I forget where I finished on that one, but it was a learning experience, I can tell you that. I can remember we went to Oxford the next week, and I was in the top five. And then a guy broke the front wheel off. And then we went to Seekonk, and I finished eighth.
Yeah. So, I mean, you did pretty well that year. What was a track that really stood out to you that you're like, I can't believe this is my life right now?
Thunder Road.
Yeah.
Very hard track to drive, but it was different.
This is before the wall. This is before the repave.
Mm-hmm.
They had the Widowmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up upside down later on in the year.
Oh, yeah.
Which let's get into that a little bit. You know, you're running for Rookie of the Year. You know, it's a pretty stout class. And, you know, we're talking about Thunder Road. You end up upside down. What happens?
I think I got a little push from Chuck Bown, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And it caught the wall that laid back, like you said.
Yeah, Widowmaker.
Yeah. And
was that the first time that you've been over like that?
No, I did it once at Beechridge.
Hmm.
Yeah. But that one there got kind of high in the air. So I didn't really Didn't really care for that one.
Yeah. Yeah, so what was it like, you know, because you had primarily grown up at the racetrack and the personalities you've been around. We talked about Ralph and Ray Leach and Bob Harrison, Dick McCabe, Walston Hume, Homer Drew. This is a completely different game with all these people from Vermont, New Hampshire, Canada. You're probably racing against Jean-Paul Cabana, Claude Leclerc. What was it like racing around those guys?
It was fun, but I mean, they kind of hung to themselves, you know. They'd say hi to you and stuff like that, but they really weren't talkative to outsiders.
Well, that's interesting you'd say that because, you know, you're a Maine team because Griffin's based out of Windham, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, Windham, Maine, you're still a new team. I think you guys were brand new to that. Like, you didn't inherit the ride from anybody, did you?
Yeah. Griffin had a car up there before me. Ooh. Dick Glines drove it.
Oh, no kidding. I never knew that.
Yeah,
no. And then he ended up with Crouch.
Yeah. And when he went with Crouch.
Lights out.
Yeah, well, that's when he asked me if I wanted to drive his car.
But yeah, still, you're the main team. And a lot of those guys primarily are from Vermont, Quebec, Ontario.
New Hampshire.
Yeah. So it was hard to get in with those guys, is what you're trying to tell me.
Well, I don't know. Like I say, I'm not a, you know.
You didn't even want to talk to people when you were winning.
Well, it wasn't that I didn't want to. It's just that I had a hard time doing it. But, I mean, the guys would say hi to you and stuff like that. And every now and then you'd, if you come in a race in a position where you're being talked to. I mean, there were some guys, and I won't mention any names, there were some guys that wouldn't talk to anybody.
Wow. Was one of them Randy LaJoy?
Randy LaJoy is a good friend of mine.
Yeah. Tell me a good Randy LaJoy story.
Oh, we went to the big track, Dover.
Yeah. How badass was that? Right?
Yeah. And he comes over and he says, "Hey, Rick, you ever driven this track?" And I said, "No, I've never even seen it other than on TV like that." And he says, "All right, well, get ready. We'll go out." And he says, I'll take you around and we'll build up speed and I'll give you some lanes to run in."
Right. And he had just won Rookie of the Year the previous year. So it's not like he's the seasoned veteran.
Right. So he gets me out there and we start going and, you know, and I just remember thinking to myself one time after he kept building up the speed I just said to myself, I said, I shouldn't even be on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, you just feel like you're going up in the air, but.
Yeah. Cause I mean, you don't lift.
No. And then when that track, when you go into the corners, it draws you down like it's pulling you to the floor because your tips are bad.
Yeah. What was that feeling like to go into turn one at Dover? This is pre-concrete now.
Yeah. It was different then, but I never had been on a track that steep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you race Sennaire?
I did.
Yeah. Did you like it?
Yeah. We didn't finish that race. We lost an engine.
Was there, aside from the point where you're like, I feel like I'm flying, were you ever intimidated by the speed of these racetracks?
I didn't like Sennaire when I first started practicing up there because it's like a triangle.
Yeah.
And when you're driving, say, from the one turn to the backstretch in the middle of it, and that makes a small turn to go the other way, you're driving 100 and something miles an hour and you're headed right at the wall.
And it's flat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, it was a track, I think, designed for IndyCar, you know, and then they put stock cars on it and, you know, all kinds of chaos broke. So, 85, I think you win Rookie of the Year, 84, you win Rookie of the Year that year?
Yes.
Yeah. So, what was that experience like to, you know, win not a NASCAR title, but, you know, a pretty prestigious award that was going to catapult you to 85, right?
I was hoping.
Yeah. What happened there?
Griffin bought a new place, and he wanted to build it up and do all kinds of stuff with it, and he didn't want to race NASCAR anymore, and he wasn't going to race that particular year because he was going to be doing all this building. So I ended up going back to Beechridge and driving my old car from back there.
So the Pepsi Challenger lasts until the NASCAR thing runs out. How come they don't follow you back to Beechridge?
I don't know. I don't know.
That's all right.
I never found out anything about that.
They just they was never a call of like, hey, we're not going to renew your sponsorship.
No.
Wow.
No. We raced there, and then when I went back, because I was with different people, I mean, they didn't have anyone to talk to that they had talked to before with me. So I don't know what really happened.
So you come back to Beechridge for the final year of the clay surface, and I believe you're driving the 21 at this point. I don't know. You've had so many numbers, we lose track.
Yeah, the 21.
Fast race car. You win a couple of races, but what's it like to come off? Are you treated any differently as now the NASCAR guy?
No, I wasn't. I didn't notice anyone. You know, I mean, you have friends and you have other guys that don't care for you and you don't care for them.
Right. No, yeah. I guess sometimes you just don't like a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
So you come back and you win. So no one's treating you any different. Then it's almost like that year didn't exist to them. And, you're back home. What was it like to come back to Beechridge?
It wasn't really different. It was just... You know, I had done it for so long at Beechridge, I just kind of felt same old thing all over again.
Well, now you have more time with the kids because the previous year, I mean, you were down in Delaware, you're running up in St. P or St. Pie. I never did figure out how to pronounce that.
St. Pie.
Pie, yeah. So you're all over the place, right? Are you able to spend any time at home?
But I took my not the older kids, the older girls, but I took my son and my youngest daughter with me to a lot of them races. Nice. I had a conversion van.
Yeah.
And would go and find a place.
Camp out?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. You come back, you win a couple of races, and then the next year, Beechridge is going to be paved. Do you feel that you have an advantage based on your experience that maybe other people didn't?
I thought I did, but I didn't.
No.
No, because the car we had just wasn't the right car. I mean, the car didn't work that well.
Who owned this car?
Joe Walker.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So just different car. Mm-hmm. Really the same.
Yeah.
You know, so you carry on, and, you know, your modified days aren't over either. You know, you're running the modified, and, you know, tell me about the time that did you drive for Pete Peterson?
Yeah, he asked me to fill in for Mike Rowe.
Stevens.
Jeff Stevens.
Yeah.
Because Jeff Stevens was running races at Oxford at that time with his car.
Yeah.
And he couldn't race on Saturday nights, and Pete Peterson asked me to drive his car.
What was it like to get behind the wheel that modified on the asphalt?
The first time I drove Peterson's car, I drove on the dirt. I mean, the clay.
Okay.
I won that race, and the next time I raced his car, I finished fifth. And that was when it was different.
That's a good way to put it. I've never heard the asphalt put as that. Hey, it's just different. How late did you run the modifieds?
That was it. Those right there were the end of it.
Yeah, 86. So you didn't run up until... When they left the speedway in 90. So, you know, you're at this point, say 1986, you've been competing 20 years at the racetrack off and on.
Mm-hmm.
Are you sensing a new breed of race car driver coming in and you're the veteran?
I never thought that I was the veteran or above them, but I did see some guys coming in that were younger guys that were looking pretty good at what they were doing.
Anybody come to mind?
Yeah. Got to think of these young guys. I can't think of them.
It's okay. Anybody seek out your advice? Because if I'm coming to Beatridge and I'm trying to learn how to get around this track, and I look at my stat sheet and I see 12 wins, 2 championships, NASCAR experience, comes back, wins 2 races, I want to talk to you.
Well, a lot of guys, well, Bob Randall and I, at that particular time, we were pretty good friends. Mm. I mean, we talked all the time and stuff like that. And he was one of the ones that I really liked. We had a problem for a year or two because it was just stupid stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How'd you bury that hatchet?
We talked.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked and, you know, we just a general conversation and everything. And I hear from him on Facebook and stuff, you know, I see his stats and all that he's putting in now, today. But I mean, we were real good friends when we were racing against each other, winning.
Yeah, running side by side, competing.
Yeah. We had a lot of good fun at that, but then other things happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when do you hang up the helmet?
When did I?
Yeah, 89.
And I finished out 89 and got out.
Why is that?
Mainly because I didn't like the car that I was driving, and my son was into sports and going into high school. Freshman year, doing very well, and I just decided I ought to spend some time with him.
You want to be dad. What was he excelling in?
He was in basketball and soccer, and then after his sophomore year, he got rid of everything except for soccer.
Yeah, isn't that neat to watch people grow up and then they just focus right in on, they find their lane. Like, you played all these sports. I'm not saying you played the sports so you didn't have to have a job. But no. It sure looks that way. But, you know, what was your son's name?
Is Eric.
Eric. So Eric, you know, plays all these sports, and he's like, I love soccer the most.
He did.
You know.
He did. He ended up, well, he got to play on the New England All-Star team in Italy for 2 weeks, and he got MVP offense.
Wow. What's that like as a dad? Be able to.
I wished I was over in Italy when he did it, because I think it would have felt better. But he come home with that big plaque. I still got it. It's on the wall.
Yeah. What were you doing, laying pipe? Were you working?
I was.
Yeah. That's cool. It sounds like, you know, you guys are tight family, and I know you miss him. He's no longer on this earth, and it's wonderful that you have that memory of him.
Yeah.
Of him. So. What do you do during the 90s?
I started to learn how to play golf.
Yeah, which is where this whole podcast leads into today. So you find a new love in golf. What gets you started in golf?
Just a bunch of guys that I knew and friends, and they were all playing, and they were playing in a scramble one day where they needed an extra guy, and
I love scrambles because you can suck and you can just be with the boys,
right? And that's what they told me. I said I don't play golf. I said I don't really know if I really want to do that. And he says, oh, come on, we're gonna have a good time, a lot of beer afterwards, they said, and
afterwards
stuff.
So
anyway,
anybody I play with, it seems like they're ripping them, like, doesn't matter what time you start.
Yeah,
they go right for the nine holes.
Well, I started doing it then, late 90s, and I never got away from it.
Yeah. So you're real into it, huh?
I am, but I'm nowhere near as good at golf.
Yeah. Who's the Homer Drew of golf that you play with?
Oh, there's quite a few of them.
Yeah.
I have some friends.
What's your favorite course to play?
I was Sable Oaks, but it closed. Uh-huh. I was a member at Sable Oaks for years.
What are you better at, driving or putting?
Putting.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah,
me too. I suck at driving. Like, I'm always the worst, but put me on a green, I can seem to kind of be okay.
Yeah, I can. I mean, I hit the balls fairly straight driving, but I'm getting older now, and I don't hit it as long as I used to, and I do pretty good job at putting, but the in-between stuff with the irons and all that stuff,
that can go
out to lunch anytime you want it to, because it does.
Yeah. What's more frustrating, golf or racing?
Golf.
Yeah. Really?
Well, the reason I come out and say that is because I don't think that I'm that good, and I want to be good. And I had fun racing, and I just, I just can't get golf up to the level that I want it up to.
But every time you and I talk, or, you know, we've been trying to put together this podcast for a while, Rick tells me, I'm playing golf, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Like, that's a lot of golf, dude.
It is. Yeah. But the guys that...
You must love it.
I do, but the guys that I play with have been doing it since high school, for God's sakes, you know, and they're just better than me. That's all. I can't say anything different.
Can you ask them, like?
Oh, a lot of them will tell me if I hit a bad ball, they'll say, you see what you did there? You
know? Condescending pricks.
Right. And I said, no. I said, I don't know what I did there, but I sure wasn't what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then they tell me.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So they will help you out. That's cool. So you don't really do anything racing wise, really, do you? Is there anything that you did between hanging it up in 89 and then picking up the pace car when, like, 2016?
No, nope. I didn't do anything.
So that must have been kind of neat to just get that call out of the blue from Andy or Ralph.
It was.
To be like, hey,
yeah,
come on back. Would you go to the races at all?
I did some, but not all of them. Eddie Walsh, the old flagman out there, him and I were teenagers together. He's a little older than me, but, you know, back in the day. And he'd say, come on out to Beechridge. And I'd go out there and he'd wave me through and I'd get in for nothing.
Yeah. You're on the Eddie Walsh guest list.
Yeah. But Eddie and I were tight friends.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a good man.
Yeah.
I miss Eddie.
He was the flagman when... The years you're talking about when I was winning stuff, and before the races started every night, he'd come over the pit area and talk to me.
So you're in a couple of Hall of Fames, you know. Then the career accolades start to come in too. You know, Beechridge Hall of Fame. I think that was 2009 or 2010, somewhere around there.
Yep.
That you come into that.
10.
Tell me the difference between being a Beechridge Hall of Famer and a Maine Motorsport Hall of Famer. The feelings going through your brain that night when you were receiving those accolades?
I was at Beechridge so long and I knew so many people and Ralph and everybody. I like going into the Beechridge Hall of Fame, but I also like going into the Maine State Hall of Fame too. I enjoyed both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was going through your mind when you were making the acceptance speech in front of, like, we're talking about Beechridge now, in front of all the people that you spent so many years with, considering you don't like talking in front of people?
I had a hard time.
Yeah.
it's just a hard thing for me to do. I don't know how to really.
I remember it. You did great. It's funny that you say that you don't like speaking in front of people, because every time I've heard you speak, whether it was Maine Motorsports Hall of Fame or Beechridge, I remember you doing, and you're doing a great job here today too. So,
Andy, but I don't have people here. Andy Cusack told me that I did a good job at the my speech at the Beechridge Hall of Fame was good, which shocked me, because I thought I didn't do anything at all special.
You were excellent. I don't remember what you said, but I remember you being up there. So now Beechridge is no longer, you know, an active racetrack, but you can drive by and see all the tumbleweed. And Do you ever drive by the racetrack?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I probably go by it at least once a month.
Really? Yeah. I can't do it. What do you think when you drive by?
I just think it's sad that it's over with.
Hmm.
I never had any part of me that ever thought that would go away.
Yeah.
But I know the fans weren't there at the end of it, and I know that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what would be worse, if you drove by the racetrack and, you know, there's the tumbleweed and kind of what you see today, which is, you know, just kind of a piecemeal racetrack, or if it, like, had already been developed, you know, because that announcement was in 2021. It's 2023 as of this recording. What would be worse for you, to see it abandoned or to see it replaced?
Abandoned. Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, even though it's still there and it's not doing anything, I still go by it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if it was a building or a warehouse or something like that, now yeah. I would think it would, I wouldn't like it at all.
So there's still a chance.
Mm.
You know. But I don't think there's a chance.
I don't think there is either. Yeah.
Well, Rick, you know, it's been an absolute blast to have you on the podcast today. Great stories. You know, obviously you accomplished a ton in your career. Are there any parting thoughts, anything that, you know, you wish that we covered in the podcast or anything you'd like to say?
Well, I think you did pretty well in what we talked about, everything there. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed doing this with you today, but I enjoyed racing. I live for it. And it's just good to be here doing this.
How often do you look through these books that your mom made for you?
Oh, I used to look at them a lot, but I don't look at them all that much now, but every now and then I pull them out.
Yeah.
Lay them on the table and start looking at them.
Do you still smell the racetrack when you're looking at them? What kind of memories come back when you do that?
I try to click into every thing that's in there, when it was and when it was done and all that stuff.
You can hear the motors around you and all that stuff. That's cool, man. That's cool. Had a lot of fun talking with Rick on the two stages we did with him, and you heard Rick get emotional when talking about his family. In our next segment, which features four-time track champion, May Motorsport Hall of Famer, and Beech Ridge Hall of Famer Bob Randall, Bob talks about a business partner, but not just a business partner. Imagine winning championships with your business partner who happens to be your best friend who passes away at the age of 35 from melanoma. And you race in his memory. Bob talks about what that was like.
My brain just goes to racing when they drop that green flag. You know, I can always remember being nervous at the start of races, but the minute that flag dropped, you go into racing mode, I would call it. But as far as John, you know, in the car, I didn't think about it, you know, but in the home, and you know, I did. I still do. You know, he was a great, great friend. Great, great friend.
It's an eye-opening and downright emotional Open Trailer podcast. Next time out, I'm Andy Austin. Talk to you next time.